On Tuesday, May 10, 1983. The interviewer is Edna Fahn. The interviewee is Helene Graham Forster, who lives in Florida with her husband Edward. She is now in Cleveland visiting children and grandchildren. Helene, in which organization did you serve? Where and for how long?
I served with the American Red Cross in hospital service in Africa, Italy, and France. I joined in June of 1943 and left in December of 1945, 2.5 years.
What did you do prior to being employed by the American Red Cross?
I was with the Home Service Department of the East Ohio Gas Company in Cleveland.
What influenced you to volunteer?
Well, I guess just the desire to serve and to be with the service personnel as versus doing something back here in this country behind the lines, as it were.
What did you do while in service?
I was called a hospital recreation worker, which in the military jargon was a hospital rec, as versus those who were with the American Red Cross club service, and they were called able-bodied recs. And nature of our work, I guess you would say, was really like occupational therapy, was to keep the patients busy and keep them, their minds off of what their problems were, I guess you'd say. Plus, my job was to do everything with the special services forces, the enlisted men and the officers, in handling all of the USO troops that came through the area that in which we were stationed at that time.
What was your uniform dress?
On duty in the hospital, we wore a gray seersucker dress with which we were allowed to wear a white collar and then our insignia on it. We were allowed to wear either a pale blue, a navy blue, or a red sweater. I can remember that. To brighten up this horrible drab gray uniform. Then we had what did we call that, street uniforms, dress uniforms, the skirt and the blouse, the jacket in both the gray seersucker in the gray Palm Beach fabric, I believe it was called, and then the regular, that gray one, what did we call it? Oxford gray, the woolen uniform, which we didn't use for quite a bit of the time. Then part of the time we were in very cold climate and we did not have any type of trousers, dress uniform type of thing. And so we were issued, the American Red Cross, all American Red Cross, hospital, club, everybody, uniforms made out of the British RAF fabric, a blue fabric, and we were issued the heavy woolen trouser and the Eisenhower jacket and a cap that matched, and we wore that a great deal.
How did what you wear compare to uniforms of the other service women in your area?
I'd say very comparable, except for color. We were the grays and the blues, and they were the OD, I guess that was what it was called, or the. And the nurses wore a seersucker pinstripe thing, a brown and a white pinstripe, where we wore gray. And then the nurses wore, their dress uniform was the green or OD, whatever that, I think it was called OD, wasn't it? Can you remember?
Yes.
I think so. And as versus the color of ours, but essentially we were very comparable in our appearances, our caps and all that sort of thing.
Were there any other service women in your area other than nurses and the Red Cross?
Not that I can recall. I can't recall that there were WACs, but I'm sure there must have been. There must have been in some headquarters someplace. There must have been WACs around, but I guess maybe we never had them as patients. Otherwise, I would remember it.
What medical care was provided for the American Red Cross personnel?
Everything the same as for anybody else, because we lived in a hospital. I mean, anything that...
That was your housing in the hospital? What type of accommodation was it? Tent or...?
No, well, yes. In Africa, we were in tent. Well, I haven't told you yet where I was. I was in North Africa, in Algeria, in Italy, and in two different places in France. In Africa, we lived in tents. In Italy, we lived in an old hospital building, lived in like an apartment building type of thing, and also in France. But we lived right with our nurses, and we all were right together. And so therefore, our medical care was all right together too. And if we had the sniffles or anything else, whenever anybody needed shots, we were right along with the rest of them. We just traveled with our unit.
Did you find overseas life demanding a great adjustment, such as living arrangements, regulations, lack of freedom?
I don't think so.
Tell us about your trip over to Africa. From what port did you leave, and did anything happen along the way that was interesting?
We sailed from New York, and after the war, after World War II, we learned that we had sailed in the largest convoy that existed in any theater of operation at any time during World War II. And we rendezvoused from 9 different ports. Don't ask me what the ports were, but I remember Norfolk and along the line there. They came out from 9 different places. We rendezvoused 200 miles out at sea. It was utterly huge. We were an enormous thing. And we rode one of the more dangerous positions of the thing, because we were in a fast ship, in a ship that could have broken away from the convoy and moved quickly.
What type of accommodation did you have on the boat?
I guess it was triple deck bunks, if I can remember right, with about 30 people in one bathroom, and the fresh water turned on. I think it was 10 minutes at a time, 3 times a day, something like that, and you lined up to take your shower and do your laundry and that sort of thing. But we were right with the nurses. We lived right with them. I don't remember many segregation whatsoever on that. And then when we came into the Mediterranean, because we were heading for North Africa, you had a fairly well single out. I can't remember that it was single file, but I mean, to go through the Straits of Gibraltar, you had to narrow down this enormous convoy. Therefore, you were literally sitting ducks to the enemy, because you weren't spread out in a vast position. And we were attacked at sea just out of Oran, I believe it was, between Oran and Algiers. And we were riding side by an airplane carrier. And of course, that's who they were after. And they, as I recall it, they got the airplane carrier, the plane carrier, but they didn't hurt us at all. I mean, we weren't hurt, but we were in the bomb situation where we all had to huddle down with our helmets on and be all prepared to go overboard, but nothing happened, fortunately.
And where did you land?
We landed first in Algiers. Then we were taken by truck out to a place called Cap Matafou, which was 20 miles outside of the city. And we were bivouacked there in the tents. And we were there just less than a week, I guess possibly 5 days. They started to build our hospital. It was to be built out of prefab buildings and that type of thing. It was under construction, and suddenly the construction noise stopped. And at dinner one night, our commanding officer advised us that Italy had just capitulated, and our orders had been changed. We were not to function in Africa. We were to be moved to Italy as soon as it was safe to cross the Mediterranean. With such a large group of women. Now, I was with the 36th General Hospital, which was from Wayne University, Detroit, Michigan, and we had a complement of over 100 women with us, counting the nurses, the physical therapists, the dietitians, and the Red Cross girls. And therefore, we were supposed to be sailed when it was reasonably safe, if there was such a thing as safety then. So we lived in Africa from the time that our orders were changed for, I think we got to Africa late August, and I believe it was late October when we finally sailed. So we were just, I guess you'd call it staging all that time waiting.
Were there any interesting experiences in North Africa that you remember?
Well, I remember having to take the, they made us, in order to try to keep us busy, I guess that's what you'd call it, they made us all take basic training, and of course we Red Cross girls had never had it in the first place, so we had to go out and tromp around, and I believe also that they issued us field boots, because I don't recall that that was part of Red Cross clothing. I think we just wore fancy black shoes, and they issued us field boots because we all, would have all had broken ankles if we had gone over this wheat stubble. We were actually like in an old wheat field. And then they set up a shower place with just some pipes coming out, and it was heated solely by the sun. There was no other heat, but of course it was hot enough in September in North Africa. And so between 11 and 12 o'clock every morning, which was supposed to be the prime time because it would be the warmest time when the pipes would be the warmest, it was the nurse's time, which of course included us. And at 12 o'clock noon, just as obviously he went by the sun, a little old Arab who came along on his donkey cart, and he would come under the guide wires of the guide lines of the tent and take the one tent wall down every noon, just as regular as clockwork, and then it would be put back up again, and we went through that daily for, I'm sure, at least a month. And we were there during monsoon season, as I recall, or I'm not sure it's called monsoons, it's called something else in Africa, but I mean it's the heavy rain season, so that everything was just all mud, and when you went into the mess tent, you'd have to be sure that somebody sat on each end of the bench, because if you sat simultaneously, because if you sat on only one side, it was just all in mud, just deep, slushy mud, and the whole table would go over, of course. It's kind of like, even though it wasn't Korea, it was kind of like MASH, I mean, that type of thing in Africa. Then we sailed, I believe it was late October, to Italy, and we sailed to Naples, and it took us something like 5 or 6 days to cross the Mediterranean, which should take like a half day, because we had a zigzag and turn round and round and round so much to be safe. And then we stayed in what had been the fairgrounds in Naples, which if anybody ever visited there prior to the war, they would recognize it was the Mussolini fairgrounds thing. And we stayed there for a couple days. And then we were set up in Caserta, which again was 20 miles out of Naples. And we were set up what had been a hospital for some 200 or more years. It had been a Catholic hospital originally, built as such. The nuns still maintained their quarters in our building, and it was built around a huge plaza thing. What am I trying to say? In the center, it was a courtyard. It was a rectangle built around a courtyard. And then we added other buildings to it as we needed them for the hospital, for the you know, the prefab buildings. And we shared a common wall with the famous Royal Palace of Caserta, which was built to resemble the Palace of Versailles. And we were in this location, so we were informed, because the palace became Fifth Army headquarters, and the Red Crosses on our roof helped to protect Army headquarters, which it did do. I mean, our area there was never bombed. And the first few days that we were there, they put the anti-aircraft guns out in the courtyard, and they were there like about one day when it was discovered that that was against the Geneva Convention to have a firearm on a hospital post, and so all of that was removed. And the post was guarded only by billy clubs. I mean, you could know, nobody could have firearms except if you had an important person as a patient. And there was a period of time at which we had General Mark Clark as a patient, and therefore his door was guarded by armed people, but other than that, not. And so our Red Cross secretary, there were two recreation workers, two social workers, and a secretary, a five-girl unit with a general hospital, with a large hospital. And so our secretary took dictation from General Clark and did something for him. So when he was ready to be discharged, he asked whether there was anything he could do for the Red Cross because of our courtesy to him. And so our assistant field director advised him that we could use a tent for our USO shows. So we were given the largest tent that the Army has, which I believe is called a big circus tent. And the Corps of Engineers built benches for us, and we could seat on benches. We could easily seat 500 men, plus the wheelchairs and the litters and all that sort of thing. And we had many, many, many excellent USO shows come through us. And again, part of my duty was to escort all of these people, whatever type of person they were. They weren't all actors. There were a lot of sports people and that kind of thing that came. And it was my duty to set up mess for them, to see to it that there was food provided for them, and to escort them through the wards of the hospital, in addition to the show that was always put on in the tent. So I met quite a few famous people along the line. But unfortunately, I don't believe that Bob Hope ever came to any place but Pacific. I don't believe he was in our part of the war. Now, you don't want me to continue with where all I was stationed, do you?
Well, I thought you probably had more interesting experiences there in Italy. And I remember you're telling me about the Christmas gifts you were passing out.
Oh, that's right. Yes, that's right. Well, I was going to say, to this hospital that we were in, I just happened to think of that. It was built as a Catholic hospital, but it had been occupied by all the different nationalities the military of the various nationalities as they went through Caserta, and it had been Italian and British and German and now American. I mean, and of course we took civilians in too. When the civilians were injured, they came in too. And then there was a period of time, it must have been about December of 43, yes, when the people who were called the Goums, who were Moroccans, they were the guerrilla fighters from Morocco.
Was that a nickname, or was that their actual tribal name?
I don't know. I guess it was a nickname. I don't know. I really don't know. But they were the guerrilla fighters who fought with these things like a scimitar, this hooked blade type of an idea, you know. And their training was to, they were very, very stealthy people, of course, and they would sneak up behind somebody and decapitate them, actually. I mean, that was the way they functioned in Morocco, apparently. So they were attached to the American Army as guerrilla fighters in the hills, because, of course, that part of Italy is hilly. It isn't really mountains, it's hills. And they all got trench foot because it was so wet at that time of the year, and we had a terrible lot of trench foot patients, I can remember that, and that was what was wrong with them. So they were brought into our hospital, and they spoke French, of course. And our one chaplain, our Protestant chaplain, spoke very fluent French, having had served the pastorates in the American Church of Paris and the American Church of Algiers, so he was very fluent, just as fluent in French as in English, of course. So he advised these people that what they had to do. You know, they had to all be deloused and all this sort of thing and get out of their robes, their burnous things and everything. But they refused to give up these knives, these blades that they fought with, and they said that was part of their, and he had told them that they couldn't have these in the hospital, but they said, though, this was part of their religion. Of course, they were Muslims. So they kept them, and they kept them under their pillows. And most of us were just a little bit leery about this if they didn't like us. So our first Christmas, we received all of our Junior Red Cross boxes from the States, thousands of them. And so Mary and I, who were co-workers, she and I were the recreation workers, so we dyed some GI underwear red, and I wasn't the size that I am today. I stuffed myself up with a pillow, and we were playing Santa Claus, so we're marching down the aisles, and on the other side of the aisle was all the American patients. So we're giving them all these little boxes, and these rooms, these Moroccan eyes were just following us down the aisle, and as we got to the end of it, I turned to Mary and I said, do you have a strange feeling that you're going to get one of those blades in your back if we don't turn the other direction and give them some Christmas gifts? She said, yes. Of course, they weren't Christian, and so we were not thinking in terms of Christmas gifts. So we just turned around and just acted as if we went down one side at a time, and we handed them the presents, and they were very happy, and they smiled. And in the box was an ocarina, a sweet potato, you know, that little flute type of a thing. And of course, that's very comparable to the instruments that they play, that the Moroccans use. So they were tooting these things and nothing flat, and they were teaching the American boys how to play this thing. So it's the age-old story, the language barrier was nothing. They, by other means, they could still communicate and got along very well. And they actually turned out to be very, very nice fellows. I mean, despite the fact they were the gorillas, they were very nice to us.
And good patients.
Yes, very good patients. And they were very good to us. They all wanted to, they did, this leather tooling was their specialty. And they tried to tool our purses, which of course was not uniform, so we couldn't allow it to be done. But they were very nice fellows. Now, and I can't think of anything else. Most important thing of all, practically, I forgot that while we were in Italy, we were there from, let's say, about the first week of November, probably, to about the last week of June, as I recall. And during this period of time, I had lost my father. My father had passed away. And being inasmuch as there was a war going on, of course, we were all just numbers, and therefore, if there was no financial dependency, if there was no dependency on the survivor, on the person who was in service, in other words, my mother was not dependent upon me, therefore, I could not return to visit her. So I kind of tried to pull some strings from the state side to try to get back, but nothing succeeded. So one fine day, one afternoon, my boss, who was the social worker with our unit, came to me at about 6 o'clock in the afternoon, just before we went to mess and to dinner, and she said, Helene, can you be ready to sail to the United States tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock? And I said, yes, I guess that I could be. So it turned out that a hospital ship, which actually was the flagship of the Atlantic Fleet, the largest one of all, a beautiful, beautiful thing, had sailed into Naples Harbor, was laying out in the harbor, because everything was mined there, of course, so it didn't come in. And the ship had come in, I can't recall the name of it now, but it doesn't make that much difference. And she had been laying in Scotland, in Glasgow, I believe it was, for several weeks, waiting for D-Day, for the Northern French, for the Normandy invasion, June 6th. And she then, typical, of course, they suddenly realized that she was too large a ship to shuttle the channel, English Channel. So she was sent down around to come in through the Mediterranean and come to Naples to take patients back to the States. And unfortunately, my understanding is that they were each issued like a 12-hour or whatever kind of a pass that they could go, because they weren't doing anything. They were just waiting for the ship to sail. And the Red Cross girl aboard somehow missed the boat, I guess you'd call it that. And she, at any rate, she was out on pass and didn't return when she was supposed to, so they had a sail without her. So when they came into port, if they had not had a Red Cross personnel aboard, they couldn't have touched Red Cross supplies, even though the captain of the thing, you know, the head of the commanding officer of the hospital unit of the thing had all the keys and everything else, but technically speaking, he could not use the supplies. So they radioed in from the harbor and asked whether they could put a Red Cross girl aboard. And it just happened that the girl who was my superior was sitting across the desk from the woman who received this call in Red Cross headquarters and said, yes, well, she turned to her and she said, can you have Helene Graham on that ship tomorrow morning? So there I was, so I sailed back to the States on leave, just had my leave, that's all, and then sailed back again.
You sailed back on another ship?
On a regular troop ship, yes, not a hospital ship, no. I only came back on the hospital ship. And when we came in, I can't remember all the dates. It seems to me it took us a couple weeks, but that seems like a terrible long time to cross the Atlantic, doesn't it? Because we wouldn't have been zigzagging. It wouldn't have been like in convoy, because we came completely lighted, brightly lighted, with our Red Crosses on.
No convoy at all?
No, completely alone. I can't recall now. But at any rate, we came back to Charleston, South Carolina. And then the patients were taken there and so forth. Now on the ship, understand, there were several hundred of the men who had been our patients in 36 General. So of course I knew loads of the fellows that were aboard ship with me. And we came in on the 4th of July. This I can remember. Now just exactly when we sailed, I don't recall that. But I'd say it took us at least 10 days to cross. Well, that's right, we had to come out of the Mediterranean, that's right, before we got into the Atlantic and started across. And we landed on the 4th of July, and well, as I said, we landed the 4th of July. That part I distinctly remember, because being a holiday, whoever would be involved in unloading, which I assume would have something to do with the longshoremen, refused to unload the ship because it was a holiday. And we had 850 men aboard, I remember that also, 850 critically wounded patients, in other words, men who would never be the same again. These were the only ones who were returned to the United States. The others were simply patched up over there and put back to work over there. In other words, we had the blind and the amputees and all the rest of this aboard. They were all critically ill. And that is something I have never forgotten. It left a very bad taste in my mouth that our troops who were doing the fighting and who were totally disabled, in other words, they were the totally disabled men that we now still have in our hospitals probably, could not be unloaded because it was a holiday. And Fort Sumter, I believe, is the name of the fort that is right there at the harbor. And unfortunately for us, first of all, there was no air conditioning. It was very hot. It was beastly hot on the 4th of July in Charleston, South Carolina. And there was a dance going on at the officers' club simultaneously. So we lay there in this heat, and our men in triple-deck bunks lay there listening to a party going on, and that didn't register too well with anybody, of course. Then after whatever amount of time I had coming to me, I believe it was 2 weeks. I guess that was sick leave. Was over. I had to report back to Washington, and I was stationed for I don't know a couple weeks. I guess it was. I'm not real sure. In Bowling Field, waiting for another ship to be ready to sail, and I went back on a troop ship. Now I can't recall that was convoy. I don't believe so, because by now we're to about August or so of 1944. But again, I went right back where I came from, went right back to Naples, reported back to Red Cross headquarters to the same woman who had put me on, Josephine Barber, who had put me on the hospital ship in the first place, went back to her, and our Red Cross unit had gotten along very well as co-workers. And so I asked whether there was any possibility of being able to return to the 36th General, and she said, your travel orders are cut. So I went right back where I came from, and the night that I, the day that I sailed, which was June, late June, the 36th General received their orders to pack up in Italy and be ready to go in for the southern French invasion. So I went right back. They had not functioned as a unit in the time that I had been in the United States. 2 months elapsed, something like that. And they were shipped to Dijon, France, Dijon, and I joined them, and they had not started to work yet. In other words, it was just a freak coincidence that the hospital was not functioning as a hospital in the interim. And I rejoined them and picked right up where I left off. The unit, all the rest of them, all the doctors and nurses and everybody, yeah, the Red Cross, everybody else, went into Marseille. They went into southern France after that and went up by train by the old 40 and 8ers business and that stuff. They went on temporary duty someplace along the line. I believe it was Aix-en-Provence. That's when I was in the United States. And then, but they went to Dijon to set up. They went the long way, let's say it that way, from southern France to Dijon, which is up at the head of the Rhone Valley, just about central France, as I recall it, a little bit farther east, closer to the Swiss border. And so when I came in and asked whether I could return to the unit and so forth, why, I was ready to go. So of course I flew, actually, from Naples up to Dijon. So we got as far as Marseille, I believe, and we're going on up. And a lot of the people that were on the plane with me, one of these little C-47s, they knew the territory. They had been around here before, and they recognized what was down below us, because of course you weren't flying thousands of feet up in the air like we do in planes nowadays. And so all of a sudden we were going the opposite way. They became aware of the fact that we were going back where we had just come from. So it turned out that our wings were icing up. Now I knew that I was on a mail plane, and I knew that the mail was important and so forth, but I didn't pay that much attention to it. So we went back to, had to go back to Corsica, which was British held. And it wound up, it was like mid-afternoon or so, and it wound up that we had to stay all night because the weather didn't clear. The weather was very bad. So we were sent to Red Cross girls. In fact, I stayed in a Clubmobile girl's apartment because she was out in the field. And I mean, we were sent back to occupy the billets of the Red Cross. And which I wasn't used to, of course, because I lived only on a hospital post. That's the only thing I knew. So the next morning we had to go out and report. We again waited several hours, and we finally took off about noon. So when we finally got to our destination, not to Dijon, it was some distance, I forget how many hours, it was late afternoon, and then we learned why they had been so particular with us. It wasn't because they had a couple of women aboard, and it wasn't because they were carrying the mail, but they were carrying General Eisenhower's aide, who in turn was carrying the battle plans. And so nothing could happen to him and to the plans, to his briefcase, and therefore we had to be extremely careful as we proceeded. So then I picked up right where I had left off, literally speaking, and working with the unit in Dijon. And we were stationed in there, not in a previous hospital, but in a what had been a French cavalry school. And we built out, oh, I don't know how many, but it must have been hundreds of, no, it probably wasn't, but many, many, many prefab buildings anyway. And we lived in like what had been the apartments of the French officers and this kind of thing. Of course, they weren't like an apartment that we know in this country. We had they installed potbelly stoves for us now, because Dijon is on a latitude with Duluth, Minnesota, so it was cold climate. It wasn't like where we had come from in near Naples, but even there it had gotten cold. So I believe, if I remember right, this is where our issue of this RAF outfit came in, because we had to be in pants and trousers, because it was in winter, it was much too cold to the nurses went into trousers in the wards. Everybody went out of these little seersucker uniforms, because we all would have had pneumonia if we'd stayed dressed that way, because it was deep, high piled snow and everything like that. We had to wear boots and or trousers tucked into the boots and things like that. So, and heavy jackets. I remember we were issued some kind of very heavy lined jackets, I guess Air Force things or something. And our Red Cross room, our Red Cross, we had a hut, a little separate building in Italy, but here we had a room which was part of the riding stable business. You know, it had the gutters around it and all. It was a great big high vaulted ceiling room. And we had our own library, and we had a complete workshop, which Mary, my co-worker, was very, very handy, very artistic. She could create anything out of nothing. And I was accustomed to working with groups, so she and I were a very good pair, because I did the group work of taking the things out to the wards, the parties, and the USO people, and this type of thing, and the parties, the sing-alongs, and all these many things that you had in the Red Cross building. And she worked with the individual patients on handwork, and we worked out as a very fine pair. And but anyway, in this hospital, what had been the riding arena of this French cavalry school was an enormously large room, and that was converted into our orthopedic ward. And again, after the war, we were advised that we had the largest orthopedic ward in any theater of operations during the war. And I remember that it was 250 beds, but I believe that it was 250 on each half, like a total of 500, but I might be wrong on that. Traction beds, which lined the walls. It was just like a forest going around this huge arena, which was like any arena, an oval-shaped type of a thing, an enormous big room. Then as a patient came out of traction and went into a flat bed, then he was moved into the center of the room. And there must have been a total of 500 or more men laying in that one ward. And so Special Services erected an enormous big theater screen out of a sheet or something like that, right in the middle of the ward, which is where the mess was served from, everything, the nurse's station, everything functioned from the center. So one night, and every night they showed movies, because these men were absolutely bedfast, of course. They couldn't get up and come to the Red Cross building or come to a USO show. So every night, the fellows would look at it backwards one night and forward the next night. You know, they would project it from the two opposite sides, and they kept them very busy. And then patients from other wards who were ambulatory, or wheelchair patients for that matter, were allowed to go into that ward and sit in the aisles and watch these movies, because we had first-run movies. We had excellent things that maybe hadn't even shown here stateside by that time. So, but it was a very interesting experience with this huge, huge ward. We had a 4,000-bed hospital. And I do recall an uncle of mine who was a doctor making the remark that he seriously doubted that all of the hospitals in the greater Cleveland area could bed down any more than possibly not even that many people in all the hospitals, because of course in a civilian hospital you have private and semi-private rooms, where we had wards with hundreds of men on one ward, just right, one right after the other. Then, from Dijon, we went to Garches. We went there. I distinctly remember that we arrived there in Garches, a suburb of Paris, and we arrived on Bastille Day, which I believe is July 14th. So we must have been from October to July, September to July, something like that in Dijon. And then we went to Garches, which is exactly midway between Paris and Versailles. And there we were in what had been a tuberculosis sanitarium, a hospital, beautiful, beautiful hospital, the Raymond Poincaré Hospital. And just as you walked out to the entrance of the hospital, there was a sign pointing so many kilometers each way, and we were midway between Versailles and Paris. And there we were billeted in regular buildings, regular concrete or, you know, brick buildings. I mean, this now we were getting very posh now after starting in tents in Africa. We had worked our way through every form of housing. And the nurses had one building, and the officers had another, and enlisted men were someplace, I don't remember. But all the officers, which was the doctors and the nurses, of course, and a certain number of the detachment, were in these buildings, which were at the top of a hill. And it was exactly 100 steps up this hill, right, literally straight up. And so they nicknamed it Cardiac Hill. I remember that. Because, remember, a lot of our doctors, and even some of our nurses, were not young men. Our men that were in charge, like the man in charge of surgery and in charge of medicine and that stuff, those men were surely 50 or more. They were not 20 years old like the patients were. And so it really, truly was, it was quite a thing, because our mess hall was down at the bottom of the hill. The only thing we did at the top of the hill was sleep. And then we had to come, in other words, if we wanted to go back to quarters during the day, it was like 3 trips a day that you had to go up and down. But we were living very posh there. So then, from there, we had a Red Cross woman, a French Red Cross, Croix Rouge Francais, attached to us. And she was basically the interpreter, because, of course, all your help in any country where you go with a great big... See, there were 1,000 Americans in our outfit, between our doctors, nurses, and 750 enlisted men, who are, of course, your ward men and your ambulance men and your motor pool and everything that it takes to make a thing this large function. So there were 1,000 of us altogether. So we had interpreters every place that we were, because your civilians were your help did the cooking and the serving and all this kind of thing, and the cleaning, all that. I mean, the cleaning of the wards, that we did our own in our quarters, of course. So this French Red Cross woman was attached to us. Her name was Agnes. And so we devised the system of taking our patients on trips to Paris and sightseeing around the countryside and so forth. And we had quite a thing functioning there. We did it several days a week. And that, again, was part of my job, was to go with them. And, of course, the patients had to be issued a uniform, because they were in pajamas and robes. And I had to account for everybody. I mean, I was responsible for them. And we'd take them to the Eiffel Tower and Notre Dame and all this and that and the other thing. So at a very early stage in the game, of course, Agnes was reciting the scenery as we went by and telling them everything that was going on, you know, as we'd go along. And she was going to give them all the history of everything. And I learned, recognized the fact very early, that the only reason they were in a uniform was just to get out of the hospital. They weren't out on a sightseeing trip. Maybe 1/10 of them were interested in what we were trying to show them. So I caught on very quickly that you simply stood at the, as the bus, we were on a bus. I don't know where we got it. It must have been a civilian bus, because it had windows. I mean, it wasn't a truck. I mean, you could see out. It was a regular bus. And I learned that you synchronized your watches. And you said, we will leave this point in exactly a half hour, whatever it was. You had time to go to the Eiffel Tower. You had time to do this, that, and the other thing. Well, of course, 90% of them went to the local bars or chased the girls down the street or something like this. They didn't go with us at all. But they were back, because they knew the consequences if they did not report back. Of course, that meant they were AWOL, and they wouldn't. So it really was quite an experience. I mean, no, I won't say 90%, possibly half of them. I guess I'm exaggerating. But a certain number of them would go with us and were very interested in the history of the place and interested in the fact that they were in Paris, and they would probably never be there again in their lives. And the rest of them, of course, did the other. So we did that, and then we were there only a few months. I believe only from July to late September, something of that nature. And then we were ready to go home. And it had this point system. I can't remember what it was. Now, this is the Army I'm talking about, but we, you see, traveled with the Army. We did everything right with them. We were not Red Cross on our own. We just did everything with our own unit. And there was some kind of a system, I can't remember it all, but at any rate, those who had been over the least time were to go direct to the Pacific. This is before the VJ day, and the various categories that there were. Some went back to the United States on a furlough and then to go to the Pacific. So for the, well, we were the longest over We had by then been over for 2 years. So therefore, we were the ones that were supposed to come directly home. We wound up being about the last ones home because we spent a couple months in the staging area at Camp Philip Morris, and everybody else was already there. In the meantime, of course, the whole war was over and it was time for everybody to come home. And by the time the longshoremen's strike in the United States was over and we were able to be shipped, we landed in New York City, came in on the Staten Island ferry. I can still picture that. It was blustery and cold, and it was Veterans Day. It was Armistice Day. It was November 11th, 1945, when I landed. And then, of course, we had to stay a few days and have physicals. And then we finally could get home. So that by the time you accrued sick leave that was due you, or however that was, I can't remember those details. But I was officially discharged in December, so I had actually been in exactly 2.5 years in service, and 27 of those months were overseas. So, is there anything else you can think of that you want to ask me? I can't... I know one thing I do want to tell you. That one of the patients, and one, my co-worker, the girl that I mentioned was so artsy-craftsy, and I that got along so well, I will be seeing Mary in about a month from now in Harrisburg. She lives in a suburb of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and I will visit her while I'm up north here now on this trip. I've seen her. We've seen each other quite frequently. She married an RAF officer who is now deceased for over 10 years, that he came to this country and married her, worked here, so forth. She had met him in Italy. Well, we're stationed in Italy, he was there. And I will also be visiting in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, a man who was one of my patients who was blind and lost his right hand. And he and I became very friendly through the letter writing. Well, I guess I forgot that part of it, didn't I, on what my duties were. That was one of the biggest things that we did. I'm thinking in terms of only the group work that I did, but of course one of the biggest things, which I'm sure everybody knows that Red Cross girls did, was write the letters for the patients. And in his case, because he was blind, I was reading them to him, those that he had received from his wife. And when he first was admitted, he was not totally blind. He had what they call traveling sight, but that was lost in successive operations. But when he first looked at me, he could very hazily make out an outline of my face now. And the very first thing that he said to me when the other patients on the ward, as I walked down, stopped me, and he said, "Here," they said, "here's the Red Cross girl, Dick." And so I stopped, and he said, "Get my wallet out of that table," which, you know, it was a table, bedside table next to each cot. And I said, "I don't need your wallet, Dick. I have nothing to sell you." And he said, no, I don't want my money. He said, "I want you to look at my wife's picture. I think you look like her." And I do. We are the same basic type. We have curly hair and wear glasses and full fat face and that sort of thing. I mean, we're essentially the same kind. So he and I became very close friends. And after we were all back, we continued to write. I had done his letter writing for him for all those months. And he was one who sailed back on the hospital ship with me from Italy. And I continued to correspond personally with his wife, Ruth. And so, I don't know, 1946, 47, somewhere along there, we met. They were in New England at that time. He was in Avon, Connecticut. They were having his training, his rehabilitation training of how she was to live with a blind person and what she did for him. And I went to visit them there at the hospital where they were. And we just met each other on the highway. We described our cars to each other and license numbers and so forth. And we walked up and introduced ourselves to each other. And that would be, what, pushing 40 years ago by now, almost. And we are still friends, and we will be seeing them next month. So I think that's kind of an interesting sidelight that you finally have kept up with some of the other Red Cross girls. I have no idea. I have an idea they're all deceased. And then there's another one who was attached to us, not one of our originals. We original five stayed together, but then as we became a huge unit, like a 4,000-bed hospital, we had others attached to us. But then they would go on to something else. And another one of the girls who now lives out in California, in Atherton, California, and I saw her last summer when Ed and I were in California, and I saw her about 10 years ago when we visited out there. So those are the only two with whom I've kept up, but I still think that's a pretty good record after 40 years that you know anybody, you know. And we're still just as good of friends. And Mary and I still have the same kind of tastes. I mean, we still get along very well. So it was a wonderful experience. It was something that there were a lot of hardships. I can't say that we lived poorly. I mean, we lived as well as anybody could live under our circumstances. It wasn't this country. But we were treated well. We were treated with great respect, and to me it was something that can never be taken away from you. When we first got there, I remember that we all admitted to each other about a year later that the very first experience we had when we really finally set up, because you see we had been there several months before we really functioned as a unit, which of course was typical. But it had to be that way because the war itself was shifting. It shifted from this country to that country, and as it moved, of course, the hospitals had to go with it, naturally. And the very first day we admitted patients in Caserta, Italy, and here we are all with our little ditty bags, you know, and we're going to do what we had been taught to do at the American University in Washington. And that didn't mean one possible thing because they were seriously wounded men who didn't need any toilet articles, they didn't need anything. So we went up to one of our nurses in the wards and said, what can we do to help you? Because our type of job there was no need for. They said, I think the best thing you can do is help us feed the patients. So I was delegated to a very, very large man. He probably wasn't as large as he appeared because he was in a total body cast. But I mean, right from the tip of his head right down, a total body cast. I guess he had a broken back or something. And just his mouth and eyes and nose were out. And I had to spoon some food into it. And I can remember one of the things that they had to eat was beets. I can still see the beets dribbling down the body cast. And as I did this, I thought to myself, my God, Helene, why did you volunteer to do this? It was just a horrible experience. And I thought, my word, I'm into this. And then I thought, well, this is it. You asked for it. You're going to have to learn to live with it. And we all admitted to each other about a year later that we all had the very same feeling. We thought, oh boy, we're civilians. We don't have to stay here. Let's all ask to go home right away. But it was a wonderful indoctrination because it was probably one of the worst things that would have happened to us. And it taught us. It brought back to us, really, why did we volunteer to serve? We volunteered because we wanted to be with the men, and we sure were. We were with those who had really given everything. And you got so that you didn't see anything. You didn't see any of the horror. And after all, we were seeing the horror of it. We were not on the front line, but we were awful close to it. And we lived in combat zone most of the time. By that I mean we got free rations, the free cigarette and the free beer ration, which meant that you lived in combat zone. So we really saw it, and I think we realized that this is why we had given up a very comfortable position here in this country and volunteered to go into something in another country, and it wasn't difficult at all. Once you became indoctrinated to looking at the horror that you were seeing with legs and arms and faces blown and that kind of thing, it wasn't difficult anymore. And you realized that your job there was to help them and to do what you could to make them as comfortable as possible and keep them in contact with their family. You were kind of the arm of the chaplain also, the Red Cross hospital worker was. I think they were in most cases. I think maybe the club people were too, but you did what they couldn't do. I mean, they only had two arms. So That's my story.
Thank you very much, Helene.